Welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Turn the Page. I am your host today, Jen, and I am so delighted and so honored to be here with a fantastic author of a historical fiction that I just could not put down. Could I ask you to introduce yourself and your book, please?
Sure. My name is Jennifer Cody Epstein, and my new novel is The Mad Women of Paris, coming out on July 18th.
Thank you so much for joining us and for, bringing this book to my inbox. I was approached by the publisher and I snatched this one up because it just hit so many of my interests. I love historical fiction. I love the history of medicine. Yeah. And I love particularly women's experience of medicine. And so, so many of my historical interests are presented here. But before we were to get into the book too much, I was wondering if you could tell me about your journey to this book. When did you start writing and how did you get interested in this topic?
I started writing it, or I guess I became interested in the topic well before I started writing it. I think it was right after I had sort of my last book, Wonderland, had come out, and I was trying to sort of toss around for the next subject. And I don't really understand why I was doing this. It was a couple of years ago. It was like, I guess, 3 years ago, but I started researching Victorian death photography, which is obviously not this subject, but it's its own thing. It's wildly fascinating and macabre. And I sort of had it in my head. I was like, well, maybe I could do something about a death photographer. And I don't know what, I don't really know what I was thinking, but I was going through pictures of clearly very not alive people, being photographed by the Victorians to try to sort of remember them, you know, for one last image before they're sort of gone forever. And then I stumbled upon an image of a young woman who was very clearly alive. I mean, just strikingly so. It was the same era. It was sort of, I think, 1870s, 1880s. And she was sort of contorting in a very dramatic fashion against a black background, wearing what looked like a sort of nightgown. And I just thought, well, what? It was so surreal and so unlike anything I'd seen before that I immediately switched gears and started researching that. And I found out that her name was Augustine Gliese, and she was a hysteric, had been diagnosed as a hysteric, and was interned or, you know, had been committed to the Salpêtrière Asylum in Paris. And there was this whole world that kind of revolved around what at the time was seen as the hysteria epidemic, not just in Paris, but really worldwide. And the doctors at the Salpêtrière, which I quickly realized were sort of medical icons in and of themselves. One was Jean-Martin Charcot, who is widely regarded as the father of modern day neurology, had done extraordinary work in terms of identifying other disorders, including ALS and Parkinson's. And in the last chapter of his life, decided he was going to turn his attentions to hysteria and try to solve that for the public in the same way that he had these other two previously very mysterious diseases. And he was also a mentor to this whole stable of incredibly impressive men who would go on in their own rights to be super influential, most namely Sigmund Freud, obviously, although he was there for a very short period. It was, the experience had a hugely profound impact on him. He ended up naming his firstborn child after Charcot. Mm-hmm. And others like Georges Gilles de la Tourette, who was Tourette's syndrome. So the Tourette syndrome is actually named for Tourette. And a whole bunch of others, Joseph Babinski. So I kind of found myself switching rabbit holes and going down the rabbit hole of 19th century hysteria in Paris and learning a little bit about what the disease was thought to be, how it was manifested, a truly spectacular, almost unbelievable array of symptoms, symptoms that these women displayed when they were having their fits, and how these were interpreted by the male medical establishment. So that kind of got me launched. And from there, it was really just swimming around in this often daunting and baffling, but always fascinating material, trying to sort of figure out where the story might be and what kind of a story I could tell that would be compelling in its own right, but also bring to light this very, up until now, pretty relatively unexplored moment of medical history.
Before we talk about the characters, I'd love to talk about your research process. Because once you sort of developed that interest and you found this new rabbit hole, what sort of sources did you look at? And in terms of crafting Josephine as a, you know, as a point of view character, or like somebody who you see, you know, very closely, did you base her on any real accounts? Is she one woman you encountered, or is she a composite of several accounts that you looked at? Like, what sort, what went into your research?
The research, thankfully, this is something that there's a fair amount of academic information on. I mean, a lot of people have been very interested in this particular period of history. And, you know, it's also in particular, I think, because it it sort of led directly in many people's minds to the modern day area of psychoanalysis. I mean, Freud had not been planning on studying hysteria. I think he'd been planning on going into clinical practice before he went to the Salpetrian, and he just became so enamored of Charcot and fascinated by hysteria that he just completely pivoted and went, you know, started studying hysteria. And when he left the Salpetrian, he began writing papers about hysteria and began exploring different ways to interact with hysterics to sort of help them. And that actually eventually led to what we, you know, he called talk therapy, which is basically modern day psychoanalysis. So, you know, there's a lot of people sort of examining this particular moment because there's so much interest in Freud still. You know, there's also a lot of, there's a growing, well, there were actually, there was a fair amount of material in English about the phenomenon of hysteria and these women at the Salpetrier and sort of how they were monitored and documented and treated. A lot of academic articles. One very excellent book as well called Medical Muses, which was published, I believe, in like 1983. I forget when, but that was super helpful. It was Siri Hustvedt wrote that, and she went into the sort of records at the Salpetrier and sort of was able to really access a lot of medical documentation. These doctors would really, they didn't do an awful lot to treat these women, but they did study them and write about them a lot and sort of took meticulous notes about what they were hearing, what they were seeing. And those records are still at the Salpetrier. So, I mean, I was able to also affirm that through independent research. But she does a marvelous job, I think, of talking about the very specific cases and some of the hysterics in particular, who became really famous in their own right because they were featured by Charcot and in both on stage and in numerous papers that he wrote. And yeah, there were other sort of lots of material on Charcot. I feel like I've now read, you know, met, when I talk about this subject, I've now had at least two people tell me that they did, you know, a PhD dissertation on Charcot, or I just came back from a college reunion and someone had done her whole, you know, graduate, or actually baccalaureate, you know, pre-graduate degree on sort of hysteria and the male medical establishment. So there was a lot on him and on his acolytes. So, you know, that was also pretty fascinating and pretty easy to access. And in terms of like how Josephine came to be, it was interesting because I sort of knew once I became somewhat familiar with this world, it felt very gothic to me. It had a very Brontian feel, and I was interested in trying to kind of merge a classical gothic storyline with this incredibly compelling and strange material that I was discovering through research. And so I sort of created her in part thinking about, you know, heroines from gothic novels that I really, you know, love and have loved and went back and sort of revisited for this. Laura was also very much informed, you know, by Jane Eyre, for instance, you know, sort of the bookish, you know, narrator. who kind of is your stalwart guide to, you know, some very strange happenings. But I think while Josephine was really a composite, because a lot of the experiments that I sort of have her undergoing happened to a variety of women, she also was largely drawn, I'd say, from Augustin Gleiz, who was the a very young hysteric. He came into the Salpêtrière at age 14, was, I think, one of the descriptions in the by one of the doctors was that she wasn't a classic beauty like Blanche Widmann, who was really perhaps the most famous of the Salpêtrière hysterics, but she was incredibly photogenic. So, you know, if you go online and you look her up, you'll just see these very striking images of her. Supposedly they'd hypnotized her and were putting her through these hysterical phases. And so she was, you know, I won't say performing because that's a tricky word, but was experiencing these hysterical episodes in front of the camera and doing it just with almost like a theatrical grace that was really amazing. So I kind of pulled that aspect of Josephine, that she's very hypnotizable, because that was one of the real requirements that Charcot had for his hysterics. He actually believed that only hysterics could be hypnotized. So if you were able to be hypnotized in his mind, you were a hysteric. There was a lot of debate about that. There were different schools of thought, but he was very firmly convinced of that. And then she's, you know, just this very sort of magnetic, charismatic, you know, quality that led her to be extremely compelling to watch as she went through these phases of her illness, which, you know, can be looked at in a number of ways. Obviously, I think the male medical establishment saw it as a great opportunity to kind of draw attention to their theories on hysteria, because it was very hard to look away from her. But I think that she also clearly used her magnetism and her power, because it was a kind of power, to draw attention to her, what she wanted to say, what she was going through. She sort of demanded to be seen. Mm-hmm. And that was another quality that I felt that I wanted to imbue Josephine with, that she was someone who would not be looked over, who would not just accept what was being thrust on her by life, but, you know, was absolutely going to give as good as she took and be heard.
I love how you phrased that about, you know, her need to, yeah, state her case and be seen and sort of not let you look away. Because it really reminds me of, you know, I studied a little bit of the history of medicine as part of my PhD. I was a medieval historian. So this is
wow.
The time period. But when you're learning the medieval, they always take you to the 19th century to see where things end up, you know. Mm-hmm. And what really, really stuck out to me was that one of the most, you know, foundational things I learned was that we view medicine as an objective science, you know, but it actually happens through the eyes of people who have biases and perspectives and like assumptions. And it really, I think, shows you how, you know, hysteria in a weird way sort of like just pathologizes, refusing to be invisible in a way, you know, any sort of like female behavior that wasn't acceptable or pretty or polite or, you know, passive, could be pathologized under this sort of like ever widening umbrella term, you know?
Yes, exactly. And
so I really love that, like, you know, she flies in the face of that. Like, it really shows you that medicine is not just an objective science, but like, a tool of social control, you know? And so was something that was on your mind when you were writing, or?
Oh, very, very much, very much. I mean, and that's also, you know, it sort of makes me think about that. We call it, you know, the medical arts, you know, for a reason, because it is an art, you know, it's a mode of interpreting. And part of what was so fascinating to me was to sort of see how much amazing progress was being made in the sciences, and even made in, you know, in terms of sort of the treatment of people in asylums. You know, I think if you'd gone back 150 years earlier, before Philippe Pinel showed up at the Salpêtrière and sort of famously humanized it, you know, you had the inmates there really being treated like prisoners, you know, chained to the walls and dressed in rags and ignored and guarded by dogs. And Pinel was, you know, I think rightly lauded for taking away the manacles mostly, you know, and, you know, trying to create a world in which these people could live some sort of a gratifying life as opposed to simply be sort of disposed of by society. But you know, you also had just these incredibly outdated mindsets and thoughts that were happening. I mean, these two things were sort of going hand in hand. You were hurtling towards the advent of the X-ray. You know, Blanche Whitman actually ended up working in the radiology department. You know, after Charcot died, she was miraculously cured of her hysteria, and then became like a worker, as many you know, sort of ex patients did, in the radiology department. She ended up working with Marie Curie, and actually, like Curie, dying of radiation poisoning, unfortunately. But then you had, you know, you still had doctors who were at, you know, fully convinced that the hysteria was caused, as Sophocles had sort of famously said, you know, a millennia earlier, by the uterus wandering around the body. And people really believe that. And, you know, I think a lot, even after they sort of stopped believing that, they still sort of held on to a lot of the tenets that sort of sprung out of that bizarre theory, which was that you needed to be pregnant to be a healthy, fully functioning woman. You had to be sort of rooted. Your uterus had to be rooted. You had to be doing what your body was supposedly built to do, the one thing you were actually built to do. And if you weren't doing that, then you were really susceptible to this terrible illness. Mm-hmm. So that was part of what was really fascinating to me as well, that, you know, you had this sort of dichotomy. And it also makes you sort of wonder, we consider ourselves to be so firmly advanced now. And yet, even as we sort of, you know, make incredible breakthroughs on so many areas of medicine, including in mental health, you know, which is much more nuanced now, and I think much more openly discussed. I'm sure in 100 years, people will look back and just be shocked by the barbarism and, you know, the sort of ignorance that, you know, is also, you know, a big part of the, you know, the process right now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I would love for you to talk a little bit about Josephine's amnesia. Because I love how it functions in this. Like, it creates really great stakes, right? Because for both Josephine and Lore are both super driven to try to recover these memories, you know, that are currently hidden. But the stakes of also uncovering that history is also like potentially disastrous, you know? And so it's sort of immediately a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation that women are in. And it's so interesting. And I'm wondering, when you are writing Amnesia, did you start out, I hope I phrased this in a way that makes sense, did you start out with a clear portrait of what was being obscured, or did the hidden past reveal itself as you wrote her in the present? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does make sense. And I started out with amnesia. You know, I knew that I wanted Josephine to have amnesia when she came in, just because it's such a mysterious condition. And I wanted her to be a really fully mysterious heroine whose backstory you really didn't know. I didn't have a full understanding of what that amnesia was really covering up for the entire book. I think the more I wrote, I think I started out with her trying to hide maybe, you know, a single act, you know, it wasn't as deliberate. It was much more passive in my mind. And then, but frankly, this is one of those books that the more I wrote and researched, the angrier I got. And I know that, which I think perhaps comes out a little bit in the writing. It's not a necessarily fun book to read, but it's very passionate. And I just decided to make her much more active. I'm not going to sort of give away the big reveal, but I sort of didn't want her to, I mean, the whole point of this was that these women were not passive. They were active in the only way that was really allowed to them. And I really wanted her to kind of embody that kind of activism and that sort of self-affirmation. So I created a much more elaborate and dramatic backstory as I went that, you know, actually in the end was much more satisfying to me to sort of uncover. And I do love, I mean, the whole damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, that is just absolutely fantastic fiction fodder. I mean, it's what, you know, what writers try to do, because that, you know, that keeps readers on the edge of their seat. Like, how are they going to get out of this?
Yes. Oh gosh.
So.
Absolutely. It's weird, because it's not a fun read, but also it is, like, it's propulsive, you know? And it's the tension is just strung along in a way that is, like, absolutely just makes it compulsively readable. And it really does give you, I think, a really vivid insight into a really important moment of medical history that affects how we see mental illness and mental health today, you know, and how we view women's behavior today. And, you know, it's just all really interesting to see that explored in such a engaging way. So thank you so much for writing this and for joining us.
It was very much my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. I know it's hard sometimes for writers to talk about this, but is there anything in the works right now?
Yeah, I have a sort of general idea of what I'd like to try to, the general subject that I'd like to try to work on. It's one that actually has sort of personal relevance to me. Actually, I guess all of them do. I mean, this one certainly, I would say Mad Women in its own way had a lot of relevance to, I think, any woman living today. But I haven't quite figured out the setting yet. I sort of started out thinking I was going to do it as another classical historical novel set in Spain under Franco. And then I started the research and I had almost visceral response, because I don't think I can do another, you know, deep dive research book. Next, I've done four in a row, and I sort of felt, okay, it's time for me to try something else. So then I was trying to set it as a dystopian sort of future story, but that wasn't quite working, and also was depressing. And I didn't want to spend, you know, the next 3 years in a depressive place. So I think I might set it more in the 70s, and sort of the rock and roll world, of women rockers, you know, and women folk singers in the 1970s. So that's what I think I'm going to be sort of diving into next. We'll see.
Ooh.
It's open to discussion.
Oh, that's very exciting. Well, I hope that whatever form the project takes, I hope you'll consider coming back to the show, because it was great talking about this book, and I can't wait to see what you do next.
I would love to come back. I love the Syosset Library, so it's one of my favorite places. So I'm absolutely delighted to return whenever you want
Great. Thank you so
me.
much. Listeners, please pick up The Mad Women of Paris. It is an absolutely essential read, I think, this summer, and it's going to be one of my favorite books of the year. I already know it. By the time that you hear this, it'll be available. So please go to your favorite independent bookstore or library, wherever you like to get your books. Thank you so much for joining us. It is now time to close this chapter.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.